This is The Resilient Life, where we believe that every human will struggle in this life. Our challenge is to struggle well. I'm Ryan Mannion. I lost my brother to war, my mom to cancer, and I'm the daughter of a retired Marine. I'm also a wife, mom, author, and president of one of the nation's leading veteran service organizations. Join me and some incredible guests as we explore the value of struggling well through life's inevitable challenges. I've been thinking a lot about the word grief, what it means, what it represents, and how I have become viewed as an expert in grief. It's not something that I want to be, but I realize that where I am in my life's journey, I've learned a lot of things. And I started thinking about the importance of sharing that with others. I've had some recent events in my life lately that have hurled me back into being the person that people reach out to say, what do I do in this circumstance? How do I help? And so I thought important to cover the most commonly asked questions I get. This is going to be more than one episode, a little bit of a series here, a series on grief. A series on grief, not for those that are grieving. I mean, it is for those that are grieving, of course, but more than that, I want this to be applicable to those experiencing grief, but also to those supporting those who are grieving. Because a lot of times that is the hardest position to be in. In order to kick things off, in order to get down to those questions that people ask, in order to dissect what true grieving is, I want to bring it back to why I've become this expert in the grieving process. And if you follow this podcast at all, if you follow me at all on social media, if you know me in any way, you know that I am the sister of First Lieutenant Travis Mannion, a Marine who was killed in Iraq on his second deployment. And that's how I say it. That's how I talk about it. My brother, First Lieutenant Travis Mannion, was killed on his second deployment to Iraq. I share tidbits about his loss. I've shared tidbits about that day. But I think what I want to do today is actually share with you what that day, April 29, 2007, looked like for me. Not only that day, but the days following. I think it's important to understand the depths of misunderstanding, the depths of confusion that I was feeling on that day and the days that followed. I'm going to read an excerpt from my book, The Knock at the Door, that was published in 2019. I say no one can say it as well as the words in this book do. And so I want to bring you back to that day and not just talk in little tidbits, not just say little phrases about my loss, but actually have you try to have an understanding of what that day felt like for me. Sunday, April 29th, 2007. I was in downtown Doylestown, Pennsylvania, scouting locations for a business I was opening. Doylestown is a quaint little suburb north of Philadelphia that evokes a different time. With a historic downtown brimming with shops and restaurants, it seemed like the perfect spot for a second location of my high-end women and men's clothing boutique, Pale Moon. Several years before, I had opened the first store in Avalon, New Jersey, a tiny resort town on the barrier island called Seven Mile Island. The business had been mostly seasonal since Avalon was largely empty between September and May. The store had become a labor of love for me, and I was thrilled to be selecting its newest location in the neighborhood where I'd grown up. I'd left my daughter, Maggie, with my parents, while I and my business partner drove a few minutes away to look at a vacant store right in the heart of town. As soon as I saw it, I knew it would be perfect. As the landlord was putting the lease in my hand for me to sign, my cell phone rang, and I saw that it was my mom. Thinking she was just checking to see where I would be and when I would be back, I ignored the call. When my phone immediately rang again, I knew something was up. My initial fear was that something had happened to my 10-month-old daughter, Maggie. My mind went to the worst place, and at the time, I didn't think that anything could be worse than that. When I answered the phone, all I heard on the other end were muffled screams. It was clearly a noise made by someone who was so broken up and in such a state of shock that he or she couldn't even cry properly. I didn't know how to prepare myself for whatever news I was about to receive. I started shaking uncontrollably. "Tell me what happened," I cried. I was terrified that something horrible had happened to Maggie. Had she tripped and split her head open, choked on something? My mind was running wild with the possibilities. Not knowing was almost worse than knowing at this point. "Have you called an ambulance?" I yelled. "Yes," answered the voice on the phone before the line suddenly went dead. The call had come from my mom's phone, but it wasn't until later that I learned that it was her sister, my Aunt Annette, who had been the caller. At the time, I had been too stunned to notice it wasn't my mom's voice. I knew that I was too upset to drive, and I asked my business partner to take me home, a 5-minute drive I had traveled countless times before. But this time, those 5 minutes felt like an eternity. And while the car was crawling through the streets, my mind was racing at 1,000 miles a minute. As we pulled into my parents' street, my heart started racing as fast as my mind. I didn't see an ambulance anywhere in sight. For a moment, that gave me a sense of relief. Maybe things weren't as serious as I had led myself to believe. My dad was standing in the driveway next to a friend, Lieutenant Colonel Corky Gardner. He and my father had served together in the Marine Corps, and he was a dear friend of the family. He and his wife lived about 45 minutes away, so it struck me as odd to see him standing there, especially since my parents had not mentioned that he would be coming over. I jumped out of the car while it was still moving. "Where's the ambulance?" I screamed. My dad looked at me with a blank look. Then, in a very measured tone, he said, "Travis was killed." I heard those words loud and clear, but they didn't make any sense to me. It took me a few seconds to process what I was being told. Since the moment I hung up the phone, I'd known that something was wrong, but this was far worse than what I could have imagined. I had thought that my daughter was in imminent danger, and here I was being told that my brother was dead. He was 26 years old. Travis and I had only been born 15 months apart, and to say that we were close would be an understatement. The fact that ours was a military family also brought us closer than most siblings. Like many military families, we had to adjust to new situations very quickly until my dad left active duty. Before that, we had moved almost every 2 years. We knew that no matter where we moved to next, no matter what school we ended up in or which sports teams we'd be the new kids on, we always had each other to depend on. Travis had been my built-in best friend in every stage of my life. I couldn't believe it. I didn't want to believe it. I collapsed in a heap right there on the driveway. I remember thinking that the asphalt felt unnaturally warm for a mid-April afternoon that had been mild. It's not fair. It's not fair, I screamed over and over again into the sky. I wanted to make sure that everyone, even God himself, knew that he had made a terrible mistake. As I screamed, my parents' neighbors spilled out of their houses to find out what was happening. My dad didn't rush to my side to comfort me. He let me get those tortured screams out of my system before I went about the hard work of trying to understand what had just happened. As had always been the case with my dad, he knew exactly what I needed before I did. I have no idea how long I lay on the ground screaming. I just know that it was long enough to get the rage out of my system. At some point, one of my neighbors helped me up and walked me down the driveway towards the house. As I walked in, I turned around and I saw an unfamiliar car parked on the road in front of the house. In my shock, I hadn't even noticed it earlier. Inside sat a young man about my age in full military dress blues. His forehead was resting on the top of the steering wheel, pressed between two folded arms that cradled his head. His eyes were closed and he looked dejected, perhaps unconscious. I later learned that this poor Marine, 26 years old at most, had been charged with the unfortunate task of sharing the news with the people closest to First Lieutenant Travis Mannion that he had been killed in Iraq. Captain Eric Cahill, as I later learned was his name, had been assigned to carry out the job since he was local and had graduated from the Naval Academy the year before my brother. Lieutenant Colonel Gardner had also been called, since the military knew that he was a family friend close by. Together, while I had been out scouting sites for my boutique, they approached my parents' door and knocked. My mother opened the door, took one look at Corky and the young Marine in uniform, and slammed the door in their faces. She simply couldn't face what was on the other side. I wasn't sure that I could either. When I reached the front door with the help of my neighbor, I stopped. I had walked through that door thousands of times before, but this time I wanted to turn the other direction and run away. I knew that deep down in my soul that once I passed through that door this time, the life that I had known was over, and there was no going back. Inside was pure chaos. My parents had been hosting a family barbecue when they received the knock at the door. Now, moments later, family members were scattered throughout the house, loudly sobbing, making hushed phone calls, and racing aimlessly back and forth. I walked into a swarm of tumultuous and confused activity, but my brain was still processing slowly. In all the chaos and furious movement, I locked eyes with my grandmother, who was seated alone in a wheelchair in the dining room, tears streaming down her cheeks. She was receiving neither comfort nor attention from anyone. My heart broke in that instant. I'll never forget that image. The rest of the day is a blur. I floated between feelings of painful shock and dark emptiness. I finally emerged to a lucid state somewhere later in the night to inquire about my daughter's whereabouts. It had been hours since she even crossed my mind. Apparently, a friend had taken her from the house during the afternoon, and I hadn't even thought to ask until after nightfall. In the days that followed, it was as if I myself were a child. I couldn't care for my infant. I could barely care for myself. I lost 10 pounds in 7 days, from the day I learned of Travis's death to the day we held his funeral. For a week, I slept between my parents in their bed. I found a bright red Marine Corps sweatshirt in the forgotten drawer that had belonged to my father, and I wore it religiously. As I sat on the back steps outside, it was in that sweatshirt. When I fell asleep at night, it was in that sweatshirt. And when I finally went to meet my brother's body upon arrival at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, I carried that sweatshirt with me. I hadn't planned to stay in Doylestown, of course. I had planned to sign the lease to the new store and return that same day to my house in New Jersey. That's where my clothing and the rest of my belongings were. So when I went to bed that first night, it was in that red sweatshirt and whatever I had worn that day. I remember being so grateful as I lay down in bed, looking forward to the moment when sleep would come over me and I could have a few hours of quiet forgetfulness, as if this terrible day had never happened. When I woke the next morning, I remembered what it felt like coming out of anesthesia. First one eyelid opened cautiously, and then the next. But my body remained frozen. My mind was already churning, going over the details of the previous day and coming to terms with the unalterable fact that my best friend and brother was dead. This marked the first of what turned out to be many anxiety-ridden mornings that would follow. Every day, I would slowly and wearily transition from sleep to consciousness, hoping that my overwhelming anxiety would not make another appearance. But it always did. One particular morning, I woke up thinking about the casket in which my brother would be arriving home from that afternoon. What would it feel like to stand in the pouring rain in the middle of an airfield with my parents and watch the casket being carried off the military aircraft? The house filled with another buzz of activity that morning as we all prepared to greet Travis and welcome him home. I stood in the kitchen with a few aunts and uncles, and one of them made a joke. What it was, I can't quite remember. But I do remember knowing that it was funny, but I wasn't able to laugh. It simply wouldn't come. The rest of the group chuckled, grateful for a break from the heavy, somber mood from the previous few days. My uncle looked at me and gently touched my arm and told me, "I promise you'll laugh again." I wanted to believe him, but I wasn't sure. The greeting at Dover was gut-wrenching. My parents and I were plagued by questions in those early days that were difficult to ignore. Who was Travis with when he died? What happened? Was it instant? Slowly, the answers started to unfold. We learned later that Travis wasn't actually scheduled to be on the mission the day he was killed. Instead, a fellow Marine slated for the patrol had told Travis he wasn't feeling up to it. Travis had been assigned to do some humanitarian work at a local Iraqi school and offered to take his place. During the course of the patrol, Travis and his team of Marines were ambushed, a firefight erupted, and they were quickly pinned down, taking fire from three sides. Travis, seeing his Navy corpsman shot and lying wounded in the middle of the road, immediately ran out into the line of fire to carry his colleague to safety. As the ambush intensified, Travis again entered the line of fire to pull another wounded Marine back to safety in a covered position. Then Travis moved out to take on the ambush that was now overwhelming his patrol. Undaunted by the onslaught, he fired his M203 grenade launcher, taking out an enemy position, and then expended a firestorm of rounds at the other positions before running out of ammunition. His efforts pushed the enemy back and changed the entire momentum of the ambush, ultimately saving the lives of his entire patrol. It was then that Travis was shot by a sniper, and immediately the enemy began to pull back. His teammates quickly grabbed him and provided what emergency medical care they could. He was rushed back to Camp Fallujah, where he was pronounced dead by the medical staff that had worked feverishly to try and save him. There's no part of this story that doesn't sound like my brother. Offering to take the worst assignment to help a friend in need. That was Travis. Thinking about the safety of others before considering his own. That was Travis too. Seeing dismal odds that didn't bode well for him and choosing to grit his teeth and answer the fire with more fire. Also Travis. My brother was a protector and warrior in every sense of those terms. I certainly felt it as a sister, and I'm proud to know that his fellow Marines got to experience it too. When I learned that he had been killed by a bullet, I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to stomach the sight of him in an open casket. My mind imagined the worst. I was shocked then, when the lid of the casket was raised at the viewing, to see my brother looking as though he was sleeping peacefully, just as I had remembered him. I approached the coffin and rubbed his head, as I had done 100 times before. From the time he was a child, Travis had always sported a buzz cut, and I felt the surface of his freshly cut hair with my fingertips. All I could think was, yep, that's Travis's head. The friends who traveled to see him lying in that casket were his age. It felt terribly backwards and wrong to see so many of them break down. For hours, I watched all of these young, strong men in the prime of their lives and in peak condition weep at the sight of my brother, who appeared to be sleeping peacefully in front of them. It was a physically and mentally exhausting day. And as much as I could hardly bear the idea of standing by that casket 1 minute longer after hours of doing so, I also didn't want to imagine it coming to an end. I knew after the last person knelt down to say a prayer in front of Travis, the funeral director was going to close that casket forever, and that would be it. I would never see my brother's face again. I rubbed his head one more last time and felt my heart sinking as my father gently pulled me away. After the funeral, the burial, and the celebration of life that followed, I remember sitting on the back stairs outside my parents' home, the same place where I had sought solace in the chaos after first hearing of his death. The winter had melted away, and a beautiful spring day had sprung in its place. I sat, arms wrapped around my knees, enveloped by the big red Marine Corps sweatshirt. I stared into the pond behind my parents' home and noticed a large goose waddling into the water from the grass. Then I noticed that she was being trailed by half a dozen baby geese. It was strange to see these lively, innocent, and sweeping creatures in spring juxtaposed against the backdrop of my own feelings, which were gray and bleak. In the weeks and months that followed, I often found myself outside, crouched on a stair in that same position, searching for my little family of geese and wondering what the day had in store for them. Then one day, as I sat there, I saw them all fly away. It sounds silly to say this now, but watching them disappear into the sky left me with such an empty feeling. All of the sadness that had been flowing through me during the previous weeks hardened into a solid knot that dropped like a rock into the pit of my stomach. Time was passing. Life was moving on. I was watching it happen, but I wasn't participating in it. I felt bitterness towards the people who could return to their normal lives, jobs, and families, while I sat on the same stair in the same red sweatshirt, terrified of what might come next. This train of thought is, of course, completely paranoid and insane. And it's a shame that pain can be so deeply pressed into our past that it robs us of the joys of our future. And though I recognize the thought process as irrational, I also know that it's just one of the many profound ways that my brother's sudden death has changed me. I'm not naive to believe that just because some devastating tragedy struck my family once, it won't strike again. It's almost as though I look for it now. I used to watch those horrific news stories on NBC's Dateline with distant fascination. Now I watch them because I want to know exactly what dangers are out there so I can prepare myself and my family for them. A 10-year-old girl walks out of the door to take the garbage out and never returns home. A young mother disappears only to be found dead at the side of a country road. I simply can't avoid these stories casually anymore. The fear and paranoia that follow in the wake of grief can create a tremendous roadblock. It stunts our personal growth and darkens our overall sense of well-being. Some people respond to unexpected and trying situations with passive acquiesce, and others with fire and fury. I responded by heightening my vigilance. After Travis's death, I found myself compelled to be wary. I was always on the lookout for the next great tragedy to befall me. This hurled me into some very dark and troublesome paths, from panic attacks to self-destructive behaviors. But it also has led me to some amazing gifts, like recovering my sense of humor and living with intention. There were many times where I managed my grief poorly, particularly in the earliest days after we received the knock at the door. In one instance, only days after Travis was killed, I saw red and completely tore into a stranger whom I felt was disrespecting my brother's sacrifice. There was a civic building in our town that, as a political statement, tallied the deaths of all of the men and women killed in the War on Terror. Travis was familiar with the building and had criticized the display as distasteful. One day before his deployment, he entered the building and told the people responsible for the display that he didn't like it. They responded that they thought it was important that the public know young men and women are dying. "If you really care," Travis told them, "put their names up there. Let people learn their names and remember them." A couple days after his death, I noticed that the number on the front of the building had increased by one. I stormed into the office and ripped apart some poor employee at the front desk. "Don't you dare change that number for my brother," I screamed at her. "He's not a fucking number." More than a decade later, I feel disconnected from the woman who stormed into that office. But that's what an unexpected and unwelcome knock at the door will do to you. In fact, grief will transform you. Whether you are grieving the loss of an identity you once had or the loss of a loved one, at some point, you will look at the mirror and you will see someone staring back at you that you simply don't recognize. It's inevitable. Maybe you'll be proud of what you see, and maybe you'll be ashamed. At some point, I bet you'll be both. The most important thing that you can tell yourself is that you get the last word. Only you can determine how your experiences will change you. And only you can be held accountable for that transformation. The experiences of April 29, 2007 ignited a chain of events that at different times has left me feeling hopeless, infuriated, and destructive. Through the years, I've bounced from convictions of strength and control to unexpected bouts of powerlessness and despair. Like anyone who has received a jarring knock at the door, literal or figurative, I've been to the darkest, deepest, and ugliest corners of my mind. From that, I've learned a thing or two. I don't hope to spare you the hurt or the pain that comes with that. I don't think that I could. I only hope to share the lessons that I learned in the process, the ones that have the power to transform you in all the right ways and remind you that you are not alone. That's chapter one of The Knock at the Door. That's my story. You know, I often talk about my life in two parts, before and after April 29, 2007. I want to talk to you about the after. And I often say that each and every one of us will receive a knock at the door. Your knock will probably not come in the way that my knock did. It probably won't be an actual knock at the door, but each and every one of us are going to be faced with an event in our lives that changes the trajectory of it. You cannot live, you cannot love without grieving at some point. And grief is hard. It's hard to talk about. It's hard to feel. It's hard to process. And it doesn't end. Recently, my friend who had just received her own knock at the door by losing her husband said to me, "I don't know how I'm going to get through this." I turned to her and I said, "You just will." I also said, "I know you can't see that now. I know you can't understand that in this moment at this point, but you will. You will get through it." So I think when we talk about this complex subject of grief, we have to be open to all the things that come with it. There is the immediate aftermath of grief, the grief that comes right after that loss. That grief is much different than the grief that I experience today, close to 16 years after my brother's death. But that grief is still there. Those uncomfortable conversations that in the beginning were so terribly uncomfortable to have, I still have them. One of my closest friends lost her child at birth. We were recently having a conversation, and she said to me, "You know, I don't know what to say when people ask me how many children I have. I want to say three, but I only have two living. What do I do with that?" And I shared with her that I thought it was situational, right? If the lady at Nordstrom's asks you, "Oh, how many children do you have?" I'd leave it at two. If someone you're having a more in-depth conversation with asks you and you're comfortable and you feel okay talking about it and says, "How many children do you have?" I'd say I have three, but one of them is no longer with us. I have those conversations all the time. How many siblings do you have? Oh, I have a brother. Oh, what's he up to now? And then I have to share that, well, he's not here. My brother died. So I just want you to understand that wherever you are in the process, if you are someone that is actively grieving the loss of someone else, wherever you are, that uncomfortableness, those weird conversations, they don't end. But I think the more we talk about them, the more we start to normalize them, right? The more we start to feel comfortable in our own skin to talk about the things that are comfortable to us. And so that's what I'm going to aim to do in a series of discussions about grief. Now, again, I shared that excerpt, that first chapter from The Knock at the Door, because it's important for you to understand my story in full detail, not the little tidbits that I throw out, but to hear that story, to understand the confusion and the chaos that was there, to understand that grief is an ever-evolving process. So if you are someone grieving, I hope you'll continue to tune in to learn more about my grief journey over the last 15 plus years. And if you are someone fortunate enough to never have experienced grief, I think these series of discussions are even more important for you. Because being someone who has to be there by the side of someone who is grieving is a hard place to be. It's a hard position to be. I want to talk to you about the things that you can be doing, the things you should be doing. And I hope to dispel this idea that there is a wrong or right way to support someone. So tune in as we dive even further into grief and its journey.